American Novel. The NBC University of the Air presents part two of a two-part radio edition of Louisa May Alcott's novel, Little Women, another in the series of books that live, American Novel.
Last week we met Marmee, the four girls, and Laurie, and learned how Meg and Laurie's tutor, Mr. Brooke, were beginning to show considerable interest in one another. The matter was discussed with the elder Marches, and all agreed that Meg, only 17, was still too young to become serious about marriage, though they all liked Mr. Brooke very much. Meg, a little frightened by the whole thing, assured Joe that if Mr. Brooke should become bothersome about it, she would promptly send him packing. Whereupon, Mr. Brooke came calling.
I'll answer. Oh.
Good afternoon, Miss Margaret. Oh,
Mr. Brooke, what a surprise.
Yes, I came to get my umbrella.
Oh.
To see how your father finds himself today.
Oh, it's very well. He's in the rack.
Oh?
I'll get him and tell it you're here. Oh. Will you wait? You wait right here.
Don't go, please.
Mother would like to see you.
Are you afraid of me, Margaret?
Oh, how can I be afraid when you've been so kind to Father during his illness? I only wish I could thank you for it.
Shall I tell you how?
Oh, no, please don't.
I love you so much, Meg, darling, and I only want to know if you care for me just a little.
I don't know.
Will you try and find out, please, Meg?
I'm too young.
I'll wait. And in the meantime, you could be learning to love me. Would it be a very hard lesson, dear?
Not if I chose to learn it, but...
Please choose to learn, Meg. I love to teach, and I think I could be a pretty good teacher.
Well, I don't choose, so you needn't be so sure of yourself.
Meg,
I don't want to be worried about such things. Father says I needn't. It's too soon, and... I'd rather not.
Oh, don't play with me, Meg. I didn't think that of you.
Oh, don't think of me at all. I'd rather you wouldn't. Oh, don't stand there looking at me like that.
Bless me, what's all this?
Oh, Andra.
Excuse me, I must see your father.
Where? And who was the young man that disappeared so suddenly?
With Father's friend. Oh, I'm so surprised to see you.
That's evidence. But what was Father's friend saying to make you red as a poppy?
We were merely talking. Mr. Brooke came for his umbrella.
Brooke? That boy's tutor? Oh, yes. I heard Josephine talking to your mother about that. You haven't gone and accepted him, child.
Oh, hush, Aunt March. He'll hear you.
Tell me, do you mean to marry this cook?
Brooke, Aunt March. His name is Brooke.
Oh, Crook, Rook, what does it matter? You listen to me. If you do marry this man, not one penny of my money ever goes to you. Remember that, to be a sensible girl.
I shall marry whom I please, Aunt March, and you can leave your money to anyone you like.
Heighty-tighty, is that the way you take my advice? It is your duty to make a rich match, and it ought to be impressed upon you.
Father and Mother don't think so. They like John, though he is poor.
This Rook hasn't got any rich relations, has he?
No, but he has many warm friends.
Oh, you can't live on friends. Try it and see how cool they'll grow. So you intend to marry a man without money, position, or business, and go on working harder than you do now, when you might be comfortable all your days by minding me and doing better.
I couldn't do better if I waited half my life. John is good and wise, and I'm proud to think that he cares for me.
He knows you've got rich relations, child. That's the secret of his liking, I suspect.
Aunt March, how dare you say such a thing? My John wouldn't marry for money any more than I would. I'm not afraid of being poor. I know I'll be happy with him because he loves me and I...
Well, I wash my hands of the whole affair. Don't expect anything from me when you're married. I'm done with you forever.
No. Dear.
Meg, darling.
Oh, John.
I couldn't help hearing, Meg. Thank you for defending me. And thank Aunt March for proving that you do care for me a little bit.
I didn't know how much till she abused you.
Then I needn't go away. May I stay and be happy, Meg?
Oh, yes. John.
A few moments later, Joe came softly downstairs, paused an instant at the parlor door, and hearing no sound within, nodded and smiled in satisfaction and pushed open the door. To be transfixed upon the threshold, going in to exult over a fallen enemy and to praise a strong-minded sister for the banishment of an objectionable lover, it certainly was a shock to behold the aforesaid enemy serenely sitting on the sofa with the strong-minded sister enthroned upon his knee and wearing an expression of the most abject submission.
Christopher Columbus!
Congratulate her, Sister Jo.
Marmy! Father! Somebody, quick, do something. John Brooke is acting dreadfully, and Meg likes it.
In the family conference that ensued, it was decided that John Brooke and Meg could be married at the end of 3 years. The two looked so happy that even Joe had to relent and be glad. Those 3 years passed swiftly. At the end of them, Meg, now 20, was married by her father in their old home. John was now in a fair way of business, and he and Meg moved at once to their tiny new house. Joe, now 19, was more deeply interested in her writing than ever, and Laurie, who was doing well in college, had begun to seem a bit too sentimental where Joe was concerned. Beth was thinner, and there was the shadow of pain in her eyes, but she never complained. Amy had grown lovely and vivacious and had begun to displace Joe and Aunt March's affections.
Are you going to the charity bazaar, Amy, dear?
Yes, Aunt March. The Chesters were kind enough to ask me.
I'm not going. They think it's a great favor.
Well, favors don't trouble me when they're well meant.
Well, I don't like favors. They oppress me and make me feel like a slave.
Hmm. Amy, do you speak French, dear?
Pretty well, Aunt Mars.
How's your French, Josephine?
Don't know a word. Can't bear French. Such a silly, slippery sort of language.
Oh, Joe, isn't it wonderful? Aunt March is going abroad next month and wants
me to go with her. Oh, Marmy.
Oh, no, dear. Not you. It's Amy.
Amy? Not me?
Aunt says Amy decidedly. And I'm afraid it is partly your own fault. Aunt writes as if quoting something you had said. I planned at first to ask Joe, but as favors burden her and she hates French, I think I won't venture to invite her.
Oh, my tongue, my abominable tongue. Why can't I learn to keep it quiet?
The house was in a ferment till Amy was off. Joe bore up pretty well till the lucky girl was out of sight, then retired to the garret and cried till she couldn't cry anymore. After which she and Beth and their mother and father took up their lives in a normal state of cheerfulness. All except Beth, that is. Beth continued to fail. One night, Joe lay awake longer than usual.
Beth. Darling, what is it?
Oh, Joe, I thought you were asleep.
Is it the old pain, my precious?
Oh, it's a new one, but I can bear it.
Tell me all about it and let me cure it.
You can't. There is no cure.
Where is it? Shall I call Mother?
Oh, no. No, don't call her.
The Beth.
Don't tell her. I shall be better soon.
Doug, anything else trouble you, Beth?
Yes, Joe.
Wouldn't it comfort you to tell me what it was?
Not now. Not yet.
Then I won't ask. But remember, Beth, Mother and I are always glad to help you if we can.
I know it. I'll tell you by and by.
The next day, Beth seemed quite herself again, and continued so for a time. But now another worry came to occupy Joe's attention. Laurie began to become troublesome. He hinted darkly at an all-absorbing passion for Joe. Now Joe loved Laurie, but only as a friend. And that's the way she wanted it to remain. She gave the matter long and careful thought and finally arrived at a solution.
Mommy.
Yes, Joe?
Mommy, I want to go away somewhere this winter for a change.
Why, Joe?
I want something new. I feel restless. I'm anxious to be seeing, doing, learning more than I am.
Where will you go?
To New York. You know, your friend Mrs. Kirk, who runs a boarding house, wrote to you for some respectable young person to teach her children, and so I think I should suit if I tried.
Joe, are these the only reasons for this sudden fancy?
No, Mother.
May I know the others?
It may be vain and wrong to say it, but I'm afraid Laurie's getting too fond of me.
Then you don't care for him in the way it's evident that he begins to care for you?
Mercy, no.
Oh, I'm glad of that, Joe.
Why, please?
Because, dear, I don't think you're suited to one another. You're too much alike and too fond of freedom to get on happily together as man and wife.
That's just the feeling I had.
Are you sure of his feeling for you?
I'm afraid so, Mother, and I think I'd better go away before it comes to anything.
I agree with you. And if it can be managed, you shall go.
It could be managed, and preparations were made. When she told Laurie, he took it very quietly, much to her surprise. So she departed for New York in high spirits. During her stay, Jo kept a very complete journal, which she sent home in weekly installments. It proved very illuminating.
Mrs. Kirk welcomed me so kindly, I felt at home at once, and I think I shall be very happy here. As I was coming downstairs this evening, I saw something I liked. I stood aside to let a little servant girl lumber up when I saw a gentleman come along behind her, take the heavy heart of coal out of her hand, and say,
"It goes better so, yeah? The little back is too young to have such heaviness."
Wasn't that good of him? Mrs. Kirk said it must have been Professor Bear. She told me that he's from Berlin, very learned and good, but poor as a church mouse, and gives German lessons to support himself. I like his looks and mean to get better acquainted. It's no harm, Marmy. He's almost 40. I'm taking German lessons. It all came about most surprisingly. In helping Mrs. Kirk put Professor Bear's room to rights, I discovered that he needed a great many buttons sewed on and socks darned. So I began looking after his linen in secret. And one day, I was knitting a heel into one of his socks and sitting near the door to the parlor where he was giving a German lesson, which I often did so as to be able to overhear and try to learn some of the language, when he popped out and caught me gabbling over a verb.
So, have you a wish for German?
Oh, yes, but you're too busy.
Ah, we will make the time. At evening, I shall give a little lesson with much gladness. For look you, Miss Marsh, I have a debt to pay. Oh, yes. You say to yourself, oh, he will not see what I do. He will never observe that his sock heels go not in holes anymore. Ah, but I have an eye, and I see much. Come now, a little lesson then and now, or no more of your good fairy works for me.
So we struck a bargain, and I'm learning German under the kindest and most patient teacher in the world.
Though very happy in the social atmosphere about her and very busy with her daily tasks, Jo still found time for literary labors. She began writing the kind of sensational short stories then so popular in the trashy weekly papers to be found everywhere. These papers paid well for their stories, and though she wrote anonymously, Jo was rather proud of the fact that they bought hers as fast as she could turn them out. But one day, she came upon her now very good friend, Professor Bear, who sat looking with disgust upon a weekly paper bearing a fearful picture composed of a lunatic, a corpse, a villain, and a viper, which adorned one of her unsigned stories.
I wish these papers did not come in the house. They are not for children to read. I would rather give boys gunpowder to play with than this bad trash.
Oh, may not be bad. Only silly, you know. And if there is a demand for it, I don't see any harm in supplying it.
There is a demand for whiskey, but I think you and I would not sell it to children.
Well, Of course not, Professor, only...
Not only do the stories like this poison the little ones who read them. They're not good for the ones who write them. Especially when the writer, she have talent, real talent, that she must use to write simple, good, true stories.
You knew all the time.
Yeah, I knew.
Oh, you make me feel so ashamed.
Oh, then please, make for me the promise that you will write only what you feel in your heart.
I promise. Gladly, I promise.
So Joe corked up her ink bottle, feeling that she needed to learn much more before she could take up her pen again. Then came spring and the time to return home. And as she bade the professor goodbye and extracted a promise that he would visit them someday, Joe surprised a look in his eye that made her blush without quite knowing why. Then she went home in time to see Laurie graduate with high honors. The next day when he came to see Joe, the look in his eye told her that her winter away from home had failed to damp his ardor.
Now you must have a good long holiday.
I intend to. With you.
No, Teddy, please don't.
I will, and you must hear me. It's no use, Joe. We've got to have it out, and the sooner the better for both of us.
Say what you like, then. I'll listen.
I've loved you ever since I've known you, Joe. I've tried to show it, but you wouldn't let me. Now I'm going to make you hear and give me an answer, for I can't go on so any longer.
I'm so desperately sorry, Teddy. But I can't help it. You know it's impossible for people to make themselves love other people if they don't.
They do sometimes.
Laurie, I agree with Mother that you and I are not suited to each other, because our quick tempers and strong wills would probably make us both miserable. So, we'll be good friends all our lives, but we won't go and do anything rash.
Yes, we will if we get the chance.
Now, Laurie, do be reasonable and take a sensible view of the case.
Oh, please, Joe, dearest, say yes.
I can't say yes, truly, so I won't say it at all. Oh, Laurie, can't you see I'm right?
You'll be sorry someday, Joe.
Laurie, where are you going?
To the devil.
For a minute, Joe's heart stood still. But then her good sense came to her rescue, and she felt sure that Laurie would soon forget. But Laurie was more deeply affected than she had dreamed. And finally, his grandfather proposed a trip to Europe to help him come to himself. Laurie listlessly agreed to the idea, and when they left, Joe felt that the old Laurie was gone forever. Now came a sad time in the life of the Marches. Beth failed steadily, and more Joe devoted her time and efforts to Beth's care. They went together to the seashore for a little holiday, hoping to restore the robot while there. Joe learned Beth's secret, that she knew she would never get well. Beth had reconciled herself to her fate and tried to help Joe see it as she did.
I don't know how to express myself, and shouldn't try to anyone but you, my Joe. I only mean to say that I've a feeling that it never was intended I should live long. I'm not like the rest of you. I never made any plans about what I'd do when I grew up. I never thought of being married as you all did. I couldn't seem to imagine myself anything but stupid little Beth, trotting about at home, of no use anywhere but there. I never wanted to go away. And the hard part now is leaving you all. I'm not afraid. But it seems as if I should be homesick for you. Even in heaven.
When the first bitterness was over, the family accepted the inevitable and put away their grief and did his or her part toward making Beth's last days happy ones. As she had hoped, the tide went out easily, and in the dark hour before the dawn, on the bosom where she had drawn her first breath, Beth quietly drew her last. Joe rebelled in spirit for a while. But gradually the tasks of living soothed her pain. And then she took up writing once more and published a story that won her real acclaim. But there was a core of loneliness in her heart that nothing could reach. Meanwhile, Laurie and Amy were still abroad. And word had come from Amy of having seen Laurie quite frequently. Then one day...
Joe, I've just received a letter from Amy.
Oh, good. What does she say?
I don't know how to say this, dear. Joe, would you feel badly if your Laurie fell in love with someone else?
Oh, no, Marmy. I'd be glad for him. Is it Amy?
Yes, dear. I think they've found a real love.
And for some odd reason, Joe's thoughts would stray to a certain Professor Friedrich Bear with a longing that she did not fully comprehend. Then one twilight, Joe was alone, lying on the old sofa, looking at the fire and thinking. She must have dozed, for suddenly...
Mommy? Oh, I don't feel well. I think I see Laurie's ghost.
A little solid for a ghost, don't you think?
Laurie, my Laurie.
Dear Joe, you are glad to see me then?
Glad? Oh, my blessed boy, I can't tell you how glad. Where's Amy?
Your mother's got her at Meg's. We stopped there on the way, and there was no getting my wife out of their clutches.
Your what?
The dickens, now I've done it.
You've gone and got married.
Yes, please. But I never will again.
Suddenly the door flew open, in trooped the whole family. And all at once everybody was hugging and kissing and talking and laughing, as though to banish in one moment the loneliness of all the past months. They hardly heard the knock on the door.
Good evening.
Oh, Mr. Bear, I am so glad to see you.
And I to see Miss Marsh.
Oh.
Oh, but no, you have a party.
Oh, no, we haven't. Only the family. My sister and friends have just come home. Oh, come in and be one of us.
Well,
I insist. Oh, here, let me have your hat.
Well, if I shall not be Monsieur de Trop,
oh, no.
I will so glad to see them all.
Oh, good. Come in. Father, Mother, this is my friend, Professor Bear.
They loved him at once. The children rushed to him like bees to a honey pot. Father found a kindred spirit. Mommy warmed to his kind heart. For a fortnight, the professor came and went with lover-like regularity. And then he stayed away for 3 whole days and made no sign. A proceeding which caused everybody to look sober, and Joe to become pensive at first, and then very cross.
It's nothing to me, of course, but I should think he would have come and bid us goodbye, like a gentleman.
If you're going out, you'd better take the little umbrella, dear. It looks like rain.
Yes, Mommy. Do you want anything in town? I've got to run in and get some paper.
Yes, I want some twill silesia and 2 yards of marrow lavender ribbon. And if you happen to meet Mr. Bear, bring him home to tea.
The dry goods stores were not down among the counting houses, banks, and wholesale warerooms where gentlemen most to congregate. But Joe found herself in that part of the city before she did a single errand, loitering along as if waiting for someone. Then it began to rain, and she discovered she'd forgotten to take the umbrella after all. Seeking shelter, she darted heedlessly across the busy street.
Oh, dear.
Surely I must know this strong-minded lady who goes so bravely under the horses' noses.
Professor Bear.
What do you down here, my little friend?
I'm shopping.
Oh? You have no umbrella.
No.
May I go also and share mine with you and carry you a bundle?
Yes, thank you.
Good. Let us go.
We thought you had gone.
Oh, did you believe that I should go with no farewell to those who have been so heavenly kind to me?
Oh, no, I didn't. I knew you were busy about your own affairs, but we rather missed you. Father and mother especially.
And you?
I'm always glad to see you, sir.
I thank you. And I come one time more before I go.
You are going, then?
I have no longer any business here. It is done. Hearts, dearest. Why do you cry?
Because you are going away.
Oh, you cry that I go?
Yes.
Oh, my God, that is wonderful. Oh, Joe, I have nothing but much love to give you.
Oh.
And I have waited to be sure that I was something more than a friend. Am I? Joe, can you make just a little place in your heart for me?
Oh, yes, Friedrich. Yes.
The emotional remarks that followed her impetuous, oh, yes, were not of a coherent character. Passers-by probably thought them a pair of harmless lunatics, for they strolled happily and leisurely along, oblivious of the rain and fog and the gathering dusk. Little they cared what anybody thought, for they were enjoying the happy hour that seldom comes but once in any life. And thus at last they turned from the night and storm and loneliness to the household light and warmth and peace, as Joe led her lover in and shut the door.
Little Women by Louisa May Alcott is one of America's novels, brought to you each week by the NBC University of the Air. Listen next week to the first episode of Diana of the Crossways by George Meredith. Many American novels in the 1947 summer series are included in the useful handbook of the World's Great Novels, which you may obtain by sending 25 cents to World's Great Novels, Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27, New York. That's Post Office Box 30, Station J, New York 27. Little Women was adapted for radio in part by Ethel Harris Gregory. The music was composed by Emil Soderstrom, and the orchestra was directed by Bernard Berquist. The entire production was under the direction of Homer Heck. Joe was played by Geraldine Kay, Meg by Martha McCain, Beth by Doris Grundy, and Amy by Mary Ann O'Neill. Marmee was played by Fern Person, Aunt March by Hilda Graham, Laurie by Charles Flynn, Mr. Brook by Larry Alexander, Professor Bear by Kurt Kupfer, and the narration was by Jonathan Hole. This is Don Elder. This program comes to you from Chicago and is a presentation of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations. Feathers are fashionable this fall. Be sure there's a red feather in your hat during the Community Chess Campaign, which starts this month. The Red Feather supports more than 12,000 community services throughout the nation. Give generously to your Community Chess. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.